Well, hello, good afternoon, and welcome to this latest Cato Institute Book Forum today on October 30th. My name is Ryan Bourne. I occupy the R. Evan Schaaf Chair for the Public Understanding of Economics here at the Cato Institute. And I'm really delighted to have you all with us to discuss Deirdre McCloskey and Art Carden's new release, Leave Me Alone and I'll Make You Rich, How the Bourgeois Deal Enriched the World. Now, this is an unusual book forum for me today, not just because it's the first one I've hosted from my bunker here at home, but because it's the first time I've actually chaired a book forum for Cato on the actual book release date. So it's especially exciting that we have the two authors here with us when I'm sure they're facing significant demands on their time. And this really is a great book. I picked it up, finished it in just two sittings. I had an advanced copy, and it's just littered with wonderful examples and covers so much ground. But I'm not going to go in and spoil it for you with my own précis. I'm going to pass over to the authors with the question, what is your book about? And we'll have a discussion for 20 to 30 minutes. And then I want to open it out into as much Q&A as possible with you guys. And just a gentle reminder, you can submit questions through a variety of different platforms today. You can submit them on the video link on the Cato website. We've got YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook viewers too. But before we get to that, let me briefly introduce the speakers. Deirdre McCloskey probably needs no introduction for a Cato audience. She's a distinguished professor of economics, history, English, and communication at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I remember reading Deirdre's books on economic history back as an undergraduate at university. She's of course also the author of hundreds of articles on economic history, economic theory, rhetoric, philosophy, feminism, and law. And most recently, she wrote her Bourgeois trilogy about how we got so rich, why so many theories about that great takeoff in living standards are mistaken, and the importance of culture, specifically rhetoric or ideas, as the key ingredient to our recent economic success. This latest book has been described by her as a more popular version of the other scholarly work, and it's been written beautifully with co-author Professor Art Carden of Samford University's Brock School of Business. He's a senior fellow with the American Institute for Economic Research, a regular contributor to Forbes, and he specializes in research on mass market retailers, economic history, and the history of economic ideas. So just kicking it off with you both, Art and Deirdre, we seem to live in a profoundly pessimistic time, that COVID is wreaking havoc on the economy and our liberties. There are difficult trade-offs everywhere, but this book is profoundly optimistic. Why are you so optimistic about the future? And I'll go first with Professor Art Carden.
Why am I optimistic about the future based on this book? Because the last 250 years or so have been so radically unlike anything that came before it. And moreover, we live in an innovative age where we value entrepreneurs like Jeff Bezos, like the late Steve Jobs, like Bill Gates. This is a really big problem, obviously, but we've had really big problems before, and we have been able to overcome them. We're pushing hard at the cutting edge of innovation, not just in treatment, but also at the cutting edge of adapting to life under adapting to life under COVID and the related uncertainty. So, while I don't know necessarily what the future will hold, I definitely expect my kids to have higher standards of living than I do.
Now, Deirdre, one of the big things that's come through your work is the importance of a culture of ideas in fostering an environment by which people can have a go, try to better themselves and their lives. And you really write powerfully about how that allowed and facilitated the Industrial Revolution and then the great takeoff. When you see so much pessimism around these days and so much anti-capitalist rhetoric, aren't you concerned that those same forces that fostered that innovation could just as well take it away?
Yes, I am concerned, and that's why I wrote the book. It turns out that pessimism sells, that it's, if you want to have a great success in the publishing world, say that the world is coming to an end, and there's this tiny thing that I favor that you can do. But in fact, the history of the last couple of centuries, as Art points out, is cause for celebration. It's an astonishing increase, 3,000% increase in real income per person since around 1800. And it came out of optimism. It came out of making people free or freer, slowly, more and more free. And then they were, ordinary folk, were allowed, got permission, as the English say, to have a go. And that's what caused this enormous increase in income per head. And so, yes, I'm concerned with the sort of eternal threat of nationalism and socialism. And if you like those, maybe you like National Socialism, 1930s style. But all we can do is preach. All we can do is keep pointing out the facts of the matter, that our life has improved even since the year 2000. Even since 1960, even since 1900, even since 1800, the world income per head, COVID aside, is increasing at about 2% per year, which is revolutionary over a couple of long generations.
And just coming back to the purpose of this book in particular, obviously you've extensively made this argument through your Bourgeois trilogy. How does this book fit into in relationship with those previous tomes?
Well, I think Art can worked. He brought this, I must say, charming craziness to the exposition of these three big tomes. Here, I'll show you. Here's one of them. Look how thick it is. and it's three of these things, from 2006, 2010, 2016. And I think these are great books, and I want you to buy them. You don't have to actually read the books, but buy them if you don't mind. And that's the trouble. They're scholarly. They're rather broad in their concerns, which is confusing to some people. And Art has done a really good job in making it, these three volumes, intelligible. And I thank him very much for that. Art, have you got anything to add to that purpose of our book?
I really appreciate that. When you first asked me to collaborate, I thought, oh yeah, let's do volume four. And so I wanted to kind of dive in and do something really fancy and hoity-toity and scholarly and whatnot. And after, yeah, right. You're right to shake your finger. And you know, after a while, it became clear that wasn't the kind of project that we needed to write. Through this entire thing, I've been thinking, you know, we bring the world good tidings of great joy, which are that life has never been this good, and life will almost certainly only get better for our children, our grandchildren, etc. Again, when I think about the standards of living that my kids can face or that my kids can look forward to, they may not be as high as they would have been in like a perfect world where every policy had been right and all that. But they're going to be much, much higher, I think, than they are now. And what we call poverty in the modern world is something that basically has no meaning if we look at it in historical and geographic perspective. If you're living in the United States or Western Europe or Canada or somewhere like that, you're one of the richest 1% of people who's ever walked the face of the earth. And I think we need to steward that well. We need to steward that wisely.
Well, but
yeah, so just
but there is, I should comment, a certain indignation that comes out when people like Art and I say that. True though it is, they say, but well, that just shows you don't care about the poor. On the contrary, if we could persuade people to have a certain optimism and to accept the amazing results of entrepreneurship and of having a go, the poor would be have been and will be the chief beneficiary. So it sounds at first like we're kind of hard-hearted and to heck with the poor, but no, that's not the case, quite the contrary. I think both Art and I have been motivated in our interest in economics and pursuing it precisely in helping the poor. As Art expressed it, one of the main characters in Les Mis is this unspeakably poor French woman from around 1830, and it's she who we care about.
Yeah, I was going to pick up on that exact topic, actually, because I remember being struck when I read Thomas Piketty's first book a number of years ago. There was a line in there, I'm going to quote it, where he said, "The poorer half of the population are as poor today as they were in the past." So we often see this conflation of inequality and poverty. And one of the things that is beautifully written in the book is this comparison between that Les Miserables character, Fontaine, I believe, against a woman in modern day Birmingham, Alabama. So why don't you just explain what you were trying to get at with that example and the big differences in their lives and livelihoods today?
I think in the grand scheme of things, and I'm glad you brought up Piketty's argument, because a lot of people do conflate inequality and poverty. And one of the reasons why people get mad when Deidre and I write stuff like this, or when we talk about stuff like this, is that I don't think either of us really care about inequality as such. I don't think either of us think that inequality is morally important. What matters is not how much Fantine is like the average person in France or how much she's like rich Jean Valjean after he's made his way, but rather what is her absolute material standard of living. And that example came from my wife and I went to see Les Mis in Birmingham about 6 years ago. I love the show, love the book. I think it's an amazing artistic achievement. And there was an advertisement in the program saying there are women like Fantine all over Birmingham. And in my cold-hearted economist way, I thought, no, there aren't. And it mentioned the median income for a household headed by a single mother with two children in Birmingham and at the time 2014. And it was by a multiple of 5 higher than per capita income in France in the 1820s, around the time that Les Miserables was taking place. So it's not just that the average single mother in Birmingham is better off than Fantine. It's that she's better off by an order of magnitude. And that's why the bourgeois deal matters. That's why economic growth matters. I'm going to be fine if the economic growth rate is 0 for the next 50 years, say. A lot of rich people are going to be fine. We care about this because we want Fantine and Cosette and their descendants to have the kinds of standards of living that we have. And indeed, my guess is that if you trace our family trees back far enough, it's not going to be that far before you hit people who are in exactly that position.
Indeed, as far as but if you care about inequality, why should we care about it country by country. I haven't ever understood that. In fact, in the last 30 years, international inequality, if you think of it person by person, which from the ethical point of view seems to me the correct way, if you think, as Art and I do not, that inequality per se is ethically to the point, then you would have to concede that person by person inequality has sharply declined in the last 30 years. Now, why is that? Because China and India are growing at fantastic speeds, because both of them moved a little bit, sometimes more, sometimes less, towards the kind of economic policy that Art and I and you and Cato are in favor of. So even if you're an inequality maven and really think that's important, you should be in favor of what Art and I call the bourgeois deal. Leave us alone and we'll make you rich. Mm-hmm. And equal.
Yeah, Chris Edwards and I at Cato have written a number of times about how, you know, these inequality statistics that you see are really just a summary, a snapshot in time of the outcomes of millions and millions of transactions, trades, inheritances, right, policies, and that on their own, these figures don't really tell us anything interesting about their underlying causes or their desirability. But I want to just shift gears a little bit, because in the book, you outline a whole range of kind of pessimisms that people have about the bourgeois deal. From you know, the traditional critiques from a kind of Malthusian perspective, right through to this idea that capitalism is inherently, I know you don't like that word, Deirdre, but capitalism is inherently exploitative of the global South. So I want to ask probably quite a difficult question to you, Deirdre. What do you think the best critique, what is the most difficult one to counter when you're, you know, pushing back on the critiques of capitalism? Is it the kind of Michael Sandel arguments that capitalism and market activity can sometimes be corrupting? Is it something else? Is it the environmental impacts of some development? What's the most difficult one that really kind of presses at you when you're fighting back on this?
Well, that's a very good question to ask, and everyone should be asked it when they're making a case. What part of your opponent's case makes you the most uneasy? And maybe it's the Michael Sandel point. I speak of myself as a Christian liberal in the classical sense, and therefore I believe that we owe the poor our concern. Though, as we just finished saying, Art and I think that the best way to help the poor is to allow economic growth to take place. But there can be, as Sandel argued, he argued it in a somewhat, well, not just somewhat, in a very simple-minded way, but there's a point there. It can be corrupting if we think that all that matters is how many toys you have. And they're great. There are temptations to that in the modern world. Then, as we say, you lose the plot. And the plot, you don't have to express this in Christian terms, but I would, is the transcendent. Whether it's the Chicago Cubs, which is also my transcendent, or it's God, or science, or art, or something, you can miss that. But I think, on the other hand, as I said in a review of with one of Sandel's books, this is very easy to exaggerate, and come on, humans have always been corrupted by the appeal of material wealth, whether they're hunter-gatherers or early agriculturalists or 19th century Swedish peasants. Humans are that way. They want goods. They want more food. They want nice objects around them. So I think, well, again, I say we should preach against the reduction of the good of life to material goods. But on the other hand, if you're starving to death, you're not able to focus on, you know, Bach cantatas. You need to get the next meal. And so it's terribly important that the bourgeois deal has spread to the rest of the world. And indeed, poverty in the world is falling like a stone. And this at least makes it possible for people to pursue the Fantine couldn't go to a well-stocked public library to improve herself, but now her descendants can.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's something that comes across powerfully in your work and some work of other scholars recently about how, you know, as human beings, we have a hierarchy of needs. And if we can actually fulfill the basics with that huge takeoff in wealth, it actually allows us to be better custodians of the planet in environmental terms and a whole range of other things. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, you get two conflicting kind of critiques of the market economy at the moment. You get a pessimism from some people that technological productivity growth is slowing down and that kind of dooms us to stagnation. And then on the other hand, you get people arguing that we're about to see an AI revolution, which is going to kill off millions and millions of jobs. What would you say to those who are coming at this pessimistically from a, you know, growth is accelerating too much perspective? We can have too much of a good thing by this AI stuff completely disrupting and upending our lives.
The story that technology is going to destroy the world or that technology is going to take our jobs and leave nothing else to be done, it's a story that people have told for generations. It's a story that was false in the 18th century. It was false in the 19th century. It was false in the 20th century. Most of American workers were in agriculture in 1900. Today, that fraction is very, very small. And it would probably be even smaller if it weren't for agricultural subsidies. And yet, we have more food than ever before and more employment opportunities than ever before. One of the reasons why I think people hate economists is that when we talk, when we speak in an optimistic way about the technological future, we can never say precisely what specific things people will do if this job goes away or if that job goes away or if the other job goes away. But something I'm noticing, we just moved into a new house not long ago, and we're trying to deal with all sorts of smart devices, a smart doorbell and smart light switches and smart this and smart that and smart the other thing. The division of physical labor, I think, is giving way to an ever more important division of actual knowledge, where day in and day out, I keep thinking, you know, I wish it were easier to pay someone to tell me how to do this, or I wish I could just give someone $100 and say, make this work the way that I want it to, and that's happening to a certain degree, but that I think is where potential future progress is coming from. I'm not worried about AI leaving no work for people to do.
Well, I'm not either. But there's a very important fact that most students of the economy don't know and should know. Every year in an economy like the United States, every year, 13% of the jobs disappear forever. Now, that sounds impossible, but it's true. The arts example of agriculture. is the obvious one over a long period of time. 80% of Americans in 1800 were on farms, 80%. Now it's 2% and falling. But the companies move away from their present location, or they move out of that industry entirely, or they go bankrupt, or they become obsolete. In 2000, here's this, there were 150,000 people employed in video stores. So I think it's just completely unreasonable to have this worry about AI.
Yeah, that's a very powerful point, Deirdre, and something that I've thought about when we were, you know, discussing the response to the COVID crisis, where the initial kind of thinking between the, you know, through the activities of many governments around the world was to try and keep the economy of February 2020 kind of preserved in aspect for as long as possible until this crisis passed, completely ignoring the fact that, you know, even if this crisis hadn't happened, we would have seen incredible churn in many of these industries. Now, I'm conscious of the fact that we have a lot of questions filing in already. Some of them kind of push back on the optimism, so I'm going to put some of them to you here. So the first question is from Travis on Facebook. He says, I'm interested to hear your opinion on what has caused an increasing amount of the gains of globalization to go into the hands of the very wealthy in recent years. Are there any problems, any smoking guns that might instruct us on why that has happened? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it something we should be indifferent to? So I'll throw that one over to you first, Deirdre.
Well, no, I think it's false. I think it's not true. And although we keep saying, oh, the rich are getting richer, the top 1% are gaining and the rest are losing and so forth. And that's just not so. And it's especially not so if you focus on individuals instead of these numbers inside a particular community. And in any case, sheer inequality. Look, do you resent it that a baseball player is paid $3 million a year? Well, why is he paid $3 million a year? Because he entertains people to that extent. Do you resent it that the Beatles, to speak of my own generation, made a lot of money? The way people make money in our society is by pleasing other people. That's how you do it. Now, if it were true that the reason rich people are getting rich is that they're stealing from other people, then I have a completely different attitude. If they're stealing or using the government to steal, which is an easier option in some ways, then I join my friends, say, and I have a lot of friends on the left in opposing that. But in the meantime, no, I don't think that inequality is the problem. I think the problem is tyranny and poverty.
Question the idea that the benefits of economic growth are going primarily to the top of the income distribution. One thing that made a big impression on me when I was in graduate school, working with John Nye, we use an example of his in the book, was the idea that the characteristics of the goods available to the very poor are coming more closely to resemble the characteristics of the goods available to the very rich. So we used an example, one that we borrow from John, asking, you know, imagine that you're invited to a king's feast a few hundred years ago. So I just finished reading King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table with our youngest, and it talks about these great feasts and they have meat and whatever. You know, we think about all the stuff that you would have at this great feast in 1000 or 1100 or 1200 or well before that, and then compare that to what you could get at Golden Corral, which is a buffet chain. Buffets are kind of closed right now, but what you would get at Golden Corral or what we could get at virtually any buffet restaurant for $15 in the United States is almost certainly better in quantity, in quality, in every possible way than whatever was providing King Henry VIII with his 5,000 calories a day.
Right.
I think that the stuff that's available to Hoi Polloi is changing very, very rapidly. Well, it's not really changing that rapidly at the very, very top of the income distribution. I can't imagine that a $650,000 bottle of scotch is really thousands and thousands and thousands of times better than a $30 or $40 bottle of scotch. And sorry, go ahead.
No. Who's speaking?
Oh, sorry. I apologize. I thought someone else was coming in.
No, just finish your thought, Art. We're all good.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yes. So I think the technological characteristics of the goods that are available to the poor are changing very rapidly relative, or much more than the goods that are available to the very rich. So right now, so my students who are in Econ 201, some of whom are watching this for extra credit, should know about the video store example that Professor McCloskey offered earlier. And I was looking at inflation adjustments since the 50s the other day. And we paid less in nominal dollars for a 50-inch ultra-high-definition TV that is, you know, can hook up to Alexa and all sorts of other stuff than somebody would have paid for a 24-inch black-and-white TV set in 1955. And that's simply staggering. If you go back to – imagine going back to – well, and Deidre, you were there in 1955. You imagine someone showing you a flat screen, 50-inch, ultra high def, internet connected, blah, 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 TV, and saying in 1955, you can have this for about $20.
Yeah, that's right. And the rich are able to buy more pearl necklaces. You see that, like Joe Biden, I have a stutter. These, by the way, are not actual pearls. That then lies at the bottom of their jewelry box is not as significant as improved food and larger amounts of food and cheaper housing and larger apartments, which is characteristic of the last half century, or indeed the last couple of hundred years.
Well, that feeds us quite nicely into our next question, because I kind of looked a couple of years ago in a paper for Cato at the cost of living for the poor in the US, and it's remarkable how many government policies actually inflate the cost of living for the poor, whether it be protectionist tariffs on clothes and food, or whether it be housing and zoning, land use planning laws raising the price of housing services. So that brings us to this next great question from Tom Selman. He says, "You're material optimists, but are you political optimists? Is it safe to believe that the great political ideas of the past will be able to overcome these socialistic and nationalist forces? Or do you distinguish between the inevitability of economic growth from the frailty of political ideas?"
Well, I must say that's why Art and I, you and everyone else, that's why we write our books, because we're trying to fend off the populism or socialism, or, you know, take the case of socialism. One of the problems is that we all grow up in families, and families are socialist enterprises. And so as a teenager, it's very easy to believe, or as a young adult, that the solution to social problems is to bring everyone into one big family called a social democracy. And it hasn't worked very well. It's not the end of the world, but it's not, doesn't work as well as it should for the poor. But it's the analogy of the country to a family is a very strong one. If you grow up on a farm, say a dairy farm, where you have to milk the cows two times a day, 365 days a year, then you don't have this attitude. Then you don't suppose that, well, everything would be okay if we just brought everyone and put them on the farm and shared. But fewer and fewer young people are having that experience. So we're going to have to argue against socialism forever. We're going to have to keep making the point that this family, as much as we all love and admire families, although sometimes they're not so good, but ordinarily they're fine. We can't use the family analogy perfectly, at least for the society as a whole. It works very poorly because it's easy to corrupt, and indeed, it's impossible in a family. You can know where the bread is in the kitchen, but in a great society, you don't know where the bread is until the market signals that I've produced it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And often we kind of, you know, often even some libertarians fall into the trap of not distinguishing between market activity that's kind of commercial activity and the creation of other civil society and family institutions that play important non-market roles in enhancing our welfare. So that's a great point. I'm going to have to move on to some more. Sorry, go on, Deirdre.
No, that's all.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the next question, which is from Robert Perry. He says, how do you prevent and punish greed, evil, abuse, monopolies, and corruption in your bourgeois free enterprise world?
Art? How do you do that? I'll
throw that to you.
So that's a fascinating question. And in a lot of ways, we're not doing ideal theory. We're looking at the world as it's developed in the last couple of hundred years and saying it's been pretty good, saying it's been sort of okay. And it, sort of the older I get, the more I realize that utopia is probably not an option. To kind of take some of these turn by turn, I don't really worry that much about monopoly. I don't worry that much about monopoly. Of course, the Justice Department just brought a case against Google, just as they brought a case against Microsoft when I was an undergraduate. I get a bit of an eye twitch, and I told my students that my head hurts when I hear people referring to a company like Google as a monopoly, when literally that very same day, I switched my web browser I switched my search engine from Google to DuckDuckGo almost immediately within Google's web browser, specifically within Google Chrome. So I think the problem of monopoly is vastly overstated. And I think that the economic history of monopoly it shows that antitrust is in a lot of ways kind of an anti-competitive endeavor. The learned hand decision in the Alcoa or in the U.S. versus Alcoa case he said all of the things that he said that Alcoa was doing, he said they're hustling to fill every void in the market. They keep driving the price down. They keep expanding output. That's exactly what the competitive model predicts, and it's exactly the opposite of what we would expect in a monopolistic market. So I also remember in the latter part of the last decade reading several articles claiming that MySpace had to be regulated as a public utility because it was a natural monopoly, that nobody would be able to compete with MySpace in the social media space because of network effects and things like that. So I'm not that worried about it. Greed is a more interesting question. And to get to a point that someone raised earlier about some kind of criticisms of the argument that we're making here, one of the criticisms of that people make of a market economy is that a market economy doesn't have a purpose as such. Rather, in a free commercial society, in a market economy, people are able to come up with their own purposes, and they're able to pursue those purposes as long as they don't interfere with anybody else. When I think about something like greed, I would agree that it's obviously not a virtue. It's a vice. But I think if anything, a richer commercial society becomes a more humane society. And again, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that societies that have more experience with market norms tend to become, again, like I said, more humane. They tend to become more generous. They tend to become they tend to develop better sharing norms and things like that. So so I would argue that if anything, the commercial bourgeois society is a response to and a solution to problems of greed.
Well, I argue that at some point in the first volume of this trilogy in 2006 called The Bourgeois Virtues, and I said, look, greed is terrible. Greed is a mortal sin. But prudence, modified with other virtues such as love and faith and temperance and courage and justice, is not greed. Greed is prudent. Let me be somewhat partisan about it and say greed is Donald Trump. Greed is having only prudence in mind and not having anything else in mind. And there's no evidence at all that occur, as Art said, there's no evidence at all that a commercial society makes that worse.
Yeah, that's another great point. And if you want more information, by the way, historical context to the current debates about antitrust policy, there's a paper called Is This Time Different? Schumpeter, the Tech Giants and Monopoly Fatalism, written by a guy called Ryan Bourne on the Cato website. So do check that one out. I'll go back to some. Who is that guy? So I'm going to go back to some questions that are flying into me. There's a question from Nimai. I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. It's for Deirdre. Could you please speak to the relationship between income growth and happiness? The question says, Adam Smith suggested that those aspiring to be rich were deluded about there being a positive linear relationship. And obviously, this is something that is much discussed in the economics literature as well. So how much of a link do we see between that income growth you talk about and actual happiness?
Well, it turns out that the early studies of this matter were incorrect, not completely correct, but that this kind of exaggerated opinion that there are very sharply diminishing returns to income growth in aiding in happiness that appears to be false. On the other hand, it's true that probably Bill Gates, who can easily afford that 50,000 bottle of scotch that Art was speaking about, doesn't get that much more pleasure than from a much less expensive bottle of scotch. But there's a kind of a misappropriation of these studies of happiness. I wrote an essay for the New Republic some years ago, attacking the whole idea of measuring happiness. And the problem is that your happiness and mine are not on the same scale. It's not like, compare it this way. It is like lumping together a person whose temperature is measured on the Fahrenheit scale and someone whose temperature is measured on the centigrade scale, and then adding them together and averaging them. Now, this would obviously be stupid, but that's essentially what these national measures of happiness are about. And is there anyone here who would not be made happier if their income was increased 100%? I vote for that. And if you'll please all send your extra money to me that's not doing anything for your happiness, or buy the book by Art and Me, I'll be happy. I'll be happier. And anyway, happiness is not our main point. It's scope, in the sense that the ability to hear Mozart or to do the mass or to paint or something is that's what's at stake, not whether or not your pleasure on a scale from 1 to 3 is 2.5 or 1.
I wrote this morning that we would probably sell more copies of the book if we named it something like "Let Us Run Your Lives" or "Everybody Dies," instead of "Leave Me Alone and I'll Make You Rich," because yeah. We have sort of a nearly something that I've noticed the other day is it seems like most public commentary is some variation on having finally identified everybody else's false consciousness. That, like, okay, you know, you just moved into a nice new house, but you're not really happier. If you let me control you, then I will make you really, truly, and rightly happy. I will make you happy in the way that you should be. And I find that this sort of presumption of control a little bit off-putting. And in thinking about some of the points that Deidre made earlier about the family, of course, our final chapter in the book is about Adam Smith, and I'm wearing my Adam Smith tie that I got for Christmas from my brother-in-law and sister-in-law. And I'm coming to understand more and more Smith's arguments about local knowledge. And of course, this is Carrie Hayek in the 20th century. We're very, very limited in terms of our ability to know what is best for others. And this here, just sort of parenthetically, like, I think this is part of the brilliance or one of the things that has made Jordan Peterson so appealing is this whole, like, clean your room mantra. And he's saying, like, if you can't keep your room, your little segment of the universe clean and orderly, what makes you think that you can order the rest of society? And to the extent that our book has a pessimistic implication is that we are pessimistic about the ability of very smart, very educated, very erudite people such as ourselves to run the lives of everybody else.
Yeah. I'm from the government, and I'm here to make you happy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does seem to be something that I remember there was a lot of discussion about this in the early 2000s, but I guess events, dear boy, events have pushed this happiness agenda to the back burner for now. Deirdre, I've got a quite specific question for you on the great takeoff. Obviously, sure. Innovation is a huge part, a huge driver of productivity growth and increases in living standards. I've got a question from Bob. How important was patent law to the great enrichment and innovation?
Zero. And it was not important at all. Joe Mokyr, McKelly, Baudrin, and others have shown that on the whole, patents, and I would add copyrights, have reduced innovation. It's the case that patents and copyrights were invented hundreds of years ago by the Venetians. And that ought to suggest to you that maybe if you want to find a source for monopoly, don't look to enterprise, look to states, the Venetian state in this case. But the problem is that once an idea has been produced, of course, its opportunity cost is zero. Once you know how to make steel by blowing air through iron, as was invented in the 1850s, anyone can do it. And from the economic point of view, should. So the counter argument, of course, is that somehow you have to earn the money to do the research of how you blow air through iron. But the ordinary first mover advantage is usually how individuals and companies get their profits. And there are just numberless examples of this, where patents have stopped innovation. Actually, an early famous example is James Watt, who in 1780 acquired at great expense in Britain a patent on the separate condenser for the steam engine, which is his most important innovation. The result of that was that innovation in steam was prevented for the length of his patent. Lots of people suggested that you could have steam locomotives and steam boats, neither of which were permitted until his patent wore out in 1800. And then there was a burst of innovation. So no, intellectual property is on the whole an evil.
Well, Deirdre, you've convinced me, or you and Mokyr and Baudrin and everybody, I've been convinced that that works in fact. I'm just not exactly convinced it works in theory. when you look at innovative firms and innovative sectors like retail, for example, to the best of my knowledge, there's not really a whole lot of intellectual property protection in retail, and yet it remains a dynamic sector. I think in this case the Watt example is really important because of Watt is in many ways a hero for coming up with this great innovation, but at the same time, he was able to take advantage of a set of institutions that, in fact, slowed down innovation.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, actually, on this point, sorry, Deirdre.
That's okay. carry on. Onward.
Well, actually, yeah, on this point, Terence Keeley has written a very interesting note for Cato recently called Innovative Economic Growth, Seven Stages of Understanding. And that attempts theoretically to lay out a reason why innovators, inventors might be willing to undertake extensive innovation despite the fact that they might not have access to kind of monopoly profits in competitive markets. And he talks about the idea of a contribution good, that you know, you're willing to engage in certain types of research because that gives you access to the research of others. So markets do have ways of finding mechanisms whereby the public good features of research can kind of be internalized by the researchers. But anyway, I'm getting down into the weeds. So let's move back to some of the questions. Got a question here from Hugo from Facebook, who says, how can your version of capitalism defeat crony capitalism? How much, you know, is there a risk of the wealthier having more political power to drive policy in their interests? So I'll start with Art on this one.
Mm-hmm. That I think is a very big question, and one that if I'm going to be pessimistic about the future, it would be about so what Randall Holcomb has called political capitalism in a recent book. He argues that political capitalism is a separate and distinct system from capitalism or from socialism or what have you. And I don't know that there's a particularly good answer to that, apart from really understanding constitutional political economy, and in particular, the role of the ethical underpinning of the constitutional framework. So I've been doing a lot of reading of the 1986 Nobel laureate James M. Buchanan in recent years, and I'm really coming to appreciate the role not just of rules prohibiting people from taking advantage of the state, but also sort of a set of ethical norms that that also kind of makes that a little bit harder. One of the major areas where I am a tad concerned is in the dynamism of the American labor market, which is a little bit sclerotic, in part because of problems related to occupational licensing. Here, though, to the extent that Deidre and I are preachers and we're preaching what we do believe to be good news, it is with the hope of convincing the median voter that they don't need that you don't need cosmetology licenses and barber licenses and hair braiding licenses and all sorts of other things like that. That I would hope is how we would be able to push back against political capitalism.
I completely agree. It's unsurprising that Art and I agree that ideology, ethics are really, really important. And that can be changed, we hope, with our preaching. But so far as the capture of the state by elites is concerned, that's human history. That's always been true. And there isn't, I think, a very good case to say that crony capitalism is new or is some special danger for the future. To look, examine as Sheila, forget her last name, has the guilds in Europe, which were exactly the seizure of the local state by the unfortunately named Ogilvy is her name. Sheila Ogilvy has done a very good job showing that these were monopolies. They weren't sweet training facilities, as some people on the left have argued.
So one of the inevitable things that happens with these types of events is that they're eventually linked to contemporary events. And because you guys are economists and you know, the impression of economists is that we really enjoy forecasting, we get asked questions about what's going to happen in the future. So I'm going to frame this question in a slightly different way. First of all, to you, Deirdre, given what we know historically in terms of the impact of pandemics, how might we think about how COVID, the legacy of COVID in terms of a framework for a market economy, the role of government, and how does that fit into the kind of model of free market innovation that you've written extensively about in the book? Where are we going to be, or where are we likely to be as a result of the
pandemic? There's a danger that the plague will result in extensions of the power of the government. But in fact, I believe that the cases, especially very surprisingly in the Western Pacific countries, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, New Zealand, Japan to some degree, and then also China and Vietnam, but those functioning democracies, they controlled it. And they controlled it by using the power of the state early and decisively. And that's what we ought to have done in the United States. And that's not a recommendation for a massive extension of the powers of the government. That it's a good idea to fight forest fires quickly before they get to be very, very big doesn't mean that we have to turn over the whole economy to the forest fighters. I think there's probably going to be a substantial investment by drug companies in preparing for the next plague. And there's going to be a next plague. Thank God COVID is not like the Black Death in Europe, which killed one third of the population. It also killed one third in China, where it came from again. So I don't think we're bound to have larger and larger governments. But as Art said, you have to preach these ideologies.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a ratchet effect. Sorry, go ahead. I think we're going to see a ratchet effect like the one that Robert Higgs identified after in looking at World War I, the Great Depression, World War II. The state has assumed an enormous amount of power. I think this gives, people have pointed out, this kind of obviates the state power or the state capacity argument for growth. Because if the COVID pandemic has shown us anything, it's that Western states have enormous capacity to basically shut everything down. I remain optimistic in that I'm bullish on Birmingham real estate, for example, having again just moved. But I do this concerns me first because it's teaching people to fear and teaching people again to sort of look to the state as their savior. And one prediction I have made that has actually sort of come true is seeing people argue that we should use the COVID response as kind of a proof of concept and a practice run for how we need to address climate change. I worry that this is going to be sort of like Rexford Tugwell looking back at the War Industries Board during World War I and saying, oh yeah, this is totally how we should fight the Great Depression. People are going to look at the COVID lockdowns and say, this is how we should fight. This is how we need to address climate change.
That's extremely interesting.
And actually there is an economist who is pushing that line of argument about climate lockdowns already, somebody that you're very familiar with, Deirdre, Mariana Mazzucato, had an article about that a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I think I'm very glad you mentioned that, because Umberto Mingardi and I have just published a book against her, against her enthusiasm for just what we're speaking of, a large state taking over innovation. She's a modern, not a smart version of John Maynard Keynes.
See, guys, you come for one book launch and you get two.
Go out and buy both books, dears. They make excellent Christmas gifts. Your grandmother will be delighted in her lockdown old age home to get both of these books.
Could not agree more.
That's certainly true. Okay, we've got time for one more question. And this one is on another relatively politically hot issue. Obviously, we had the 1619 project from the New York Times fairly recently. That brought up the whole debate about the extent to which the role of slavery actually provided the foundations for a capitalist takeoff in the United States. Deirdre, this is something you've written about very extensively. So there's an anonymous question here just asking, you know, what was the role of slavery in the development of capitalism? Did it actually reduce the productive capacity of the economy? Did it increase it? Was the foundation of the capitalist economy here based on that exploitation and slavery?
Yeah, we have a chapter in the very book we're speaking of on this, and we present briefly the evidence against the idea that slavery was foundational to what is unfortunately called capitalism. And the arguments against it are just, against this hypothesis, are just overwhelming. If it were true that slavery was the key to enrichment, then Canada would be poor and the United States would be rich, because Canada basically hasn't ever had any slavery. Slaves would escape to Canada, as you know, before the Civil War. New Zealand, which didn't enslave the population of Maoris that it found there, would be poor. Britain itself would be poor. Britain abolished slavery on the soil of Britain completely in 1780, and it abolished with the United States the slave trade in 1807, and it abolished slavery in the empire in 1834. And if slavery were such a wonderful way to get rich, Britain would be unspeakably poor now, and only the United States, with its rather small slave population, would be rich. If slavery were the way to wealth, Brazil, which imported, because it was much closer to Africa, imported vastly more slaves than were imported by the United States, would be rich. And the United States, which only imported a few and stopped officially in 1807, would be poor. I mean, you can just go on and on. There's an East African slave trade, which was longer and as large as West African trade. Most of the slaves in the Western Hemisphere come from Western Africa. A great deal of the population of the Middle East has slave ancestors from East Africa, black slave ancestors. Slavery is characteristic of lots of societies, not all of them, but lots of them. The word slave, as you know, comes from Slav, because the Golden Horde, the the heirs of Genghis Khan in the area north of the Black Sea were raiding the beginnings of Russia and exporting those people into the slave markets of Constantinople and then Istanbul. So slavery is not correlated. And then if you get into the details of the economics, as Art and I, as kind of observers of this, I don't think either of us has done the scientific work, but we have friends who have, friends and admired models, and they look into it. And slavery was not necessary for cotton. I mean, I could go on and on about this. It's not the case that cotton needed slavery. There were lots of free white people who grew cotton before the Civil War. And in 1807, shortly after the Civil War, cotton production in the South, now with free people, was equal to what it was in 1860. So there's the case, although it's very popular and makes us all feel guilty. And then there's one more point. If you feel guilty about that exploitation, and it was terrible, and I wish it hadn't happened, what about the exploitation of women through the ages? Do they need compensation now? What about the my ancestors? We can go back 1,000 years. My Norwegian ancestors enslaved my Irish ancestors. There's a substantial amount of Irish genes in the population of Western Norway to this day. Now let's see, what do? Take from one of my purses and money and put it in the other? So you can see I'm very unhappy with this 1619 project. Not that I approve of slavery, I'm against it.
Well, on that less optimistic note, I will remind you this is an incredibly optimistic book. Highly recommend going out and buying it today. So it's Leave Me Alone and I'll Make You Rich, How the Bourgeois Deal Enrich the World. I apologize to all of you on any of our platforms, whether that be on the Cato website or Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, whose questions that I didn't get to. We have a hell of a lot of questions coming in, and it's sometimes quite difficult for me as a moderator to be able to read through and select all of them. So I apologize if we didn't get to your question. I wish that we could all be back with you in person at Cato, and hopefully we will do soon. And I know that if we were able to, and if we weren't virtual today, we'd now be giving a huge round of applause and wishing our thanks to Deirdre McCloskey and Professor Art Carden for spending their time with us. So thank you for being with us. Have a great weekend.